Hi, my name is Jordy Miller. I worked on water and Islam in the first wave. The water is an affirmative. Islam is a political mishap and a critique. And I worked with Tone in the second wave on oil. Got a lot of stuff on oil. Caspian did that, renewables did that, and a bunch of Iran and Iraq make arguments both ways about their availability of oil, the effects of sanctions thereof. And that's the answer to the question.
In the second wave, I did recording for that is the oil. The oil, series of oil arguments. In the first wave, I worked with Jethro and we. The group put together an argument that lifting of sanctions against the different target nations would remove the primary or sole remaining obstacle to U.S.-European agreement on something called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment. The Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which could go by several names, is an effort by the leading economies of the world to lock in the same type of prohibitions against regulation that exist that were removed on trade and gas, now on financial investments. So it's deregulating international capital flows and limiting the powers of all governments that would be signatory to the treaty at least to in any way interfere with investments or repatriation of profits by companies investing in other nations. That's what it does. And the reason that Europe and the United States, which currently do support that idea, and both all 29 OECD nations would like to see it happen, the thing that is blocking it, the gum in the works, are frictions over U.S. sanctions towards these target nations. And that friction would be removed by the plan, allowing for them to make reach agreement on this thing. Now, the reason is that there are a couple of different reasons that reaching agreement on this regime to liberalize international capital flows is bad. One is it would prevent the ability of governments around the world, including ours, to direct or regulate investment in such a way as to protect the environment. We must invest in this way or regulate industries that might tend to retard their profit return. That would probably be problematic under PIA, MAI. That's one scenario. Another is that although there are advocates of this kind of regime to help promote economic growth, that kind of chaotic environment where there are no regulations on capital flows would be extremely destabilizing to the environment. And there are some good empirical parts about how that was the first whiff of that problem we saw in the Asian flu last year, partially continuing to this year. And then there are two other impact scenarios. One is that it would cause a massive increase in weapons proliferation. There are a number of reasons for this. There's a second level link that strong U.S.-European cooperation leads to second wave NATO expansion, and that's bad. But then there's also that the only thing exempted from the MAI are state expenditures on weapons. So as an instrument of leverage over their economy, directing R&D in their nation, all state spending and social programs, environmental regs would be basically at least questionable, would be channeled into military spending and would be a massive arms race. The Staples evidence in the show is extremely on point about this, and that's bad for a variety of reasons. And then the last and final impact is that it would have an extremely negative impact on human rights efforts to try and promote human rights regimes. Even international treaties that try and protect human rights might become suspect under this agreement. And that would fall particularly hard on poor women around the world. The other side of the argument is that there are lots of things that will prevent an agreement. There are some good cards that tensions are already being soothed over these sanctions in these target nations. And then there are some arguments that MAI will help the environment by eliminating inefficiencies in the allocation of resources across the globe. There would be efficiencies if we liberalized investment that would allow for the optimal, most efficient production techniques without harming the environment. And then there are also people who say it will be a huge boom to growth around the world. We didn't really get into growth, good and bad, a whole lot. That's about the position we're working on for now.
Hi, I'm Max, I guess. I got to work with Jackie Massey in both ways. The first wave we had was generic sanctions, constructive engagement assignment, and we elected to focus more on the evidence that says that sanctions are good. Didn't seem like we needed to put out inherency evidence for everybody, so we opted out of most of those parts, so you won't find a lot of that stuff in there. What you will find is a generic defense of sanctions that one ends hopefully will be able to use in virtually all circumstances. They indicate that sanctions are good for a few reasons, like they're tools of our national value system. They are effective, they've worked, they increase cooperation, and they also provide us with leverage in other international agreements. And there are a few sanctions bad cards in there, generically, two or three reasons why. But for the most part, we try to stick to one in C negative cards that we thought we could use. Additionally, we put in a few cards about every country that's outlined so that hopefully, even if you don't have anything specific to that country, you'll have a few cards to help you at least make a generic sanctions argument on the case so that you can try to defend the status quo if that's your option. That's your choice. In the second wave, we did Russia. Looks like there are probably three positions, well, four, I guess, total. The first one is a nationalism dissent. It says that right now the liberal democratic forces within the Russian government are using our sanctions as a tool. And the way that they use that is they oppose our sanctions in order to quell nationalist uprisings in Russian politics, in the Russian political system. So they need the opposition of U.S. sanctions in order to keep nationalism at home at bay. And if the U.S. removes those sanctions, the nationalists will spark up because they hate any increase in the Western model of integration and economic growth. And once they do that, it leads to various scenarios for impacts, including increasing the arms race, Middle Eastern military adventurism, return to Cold War, stuff like that. The second scenario is a Russian economy oil position, which kind of goes with what Trump was talking about. He says that the economy in Russia is dependent on being able to market oil to the rogue states, and once we normalize our relations, they will be undercut, and prices will drop, price shocks will occur, and we'll drop the prices, which will also undercut Russian oil, and when that occurs, it bankrupts their economy, which leads to various bad things, like them sparking out against the Russian states, the former Soviet states, and stuff like that. So, and the third scenario is arms sales itself. That arms sales are a significant product of the Russian economy, and that it's a pretty big market sector for employment. When we normalize our agreements and our arms exporters, companies here start exporting arms to places like Iran, Iraq, etc., that'll undercut the Russian arms market, which will lead to internal economic collapse. That internal economic loss results in the same thing as the oil scenario. The fourth thing is a consultation counterplan, and I don't know. There's not a lot of great evidence about consulting, and we found a few cards here and there that say that we should consult first. For the most part, though, it seems like the Russians are a problem. They oppose our sanctions in most places, so it seems like if you remove sanctions most of the time, they're not going to go, no, stop. And they seem pretty happy about it most of the time. Because absent the link stories that I talked about previously, there's a lot of intuitive reasons why the Russians would like for us to remove our sanctions and start engaging in the Middle East, like the oil pipeline, like trying to decide which way it's going to go through which countries and stuff. So and that's all dependent on the U.S. Additionally, there is some evidence that the United States is sanctioning Russian companies as a result of our sanctions against, like, Cuba, and that those sanctions increase tensions with the Russians, that we should consult first with the company and stuff in order to try to solve that problem. And that's about it. Just those four, and then the sanctions stuff in the first minute.
In the first wave, I worked on North Korea with Mark West, and I saw him talking about it a little bit earlier, but I don't know how much he discussed, so I'll cover what I think are the basics. It claims a hunger advantage, and it claims, the hunger advantage is pretty much the most important part of the case. There's a lot of people dying. 10% of the population has died in the last 3 years as a result of a lack of food. The situation is pretty bad. All of the evidence that describes the situation that exists in the 1AC is pretty thorough, pretty on point. September is the next harvest, except that the majority of the food that they're growing in the next harvest was sent in the form of U.S. aid that arrived too late for the planting season, so the harvest is currently rotting in the ground. There probably won't be a September harvest. They need food aid. The plan gives them food aid. It decreases all economic sanctions too, which we claim is, I think we claim increased relations is what we claim off of that in the 1AC. It's a pretty straightforward case. The case does have some significant holes in it, and that is that there are good turn cards to engagement with North Korea, and although it's really hard, that's the bad part of the case. The bad part of the case is that the sanctions part is pretty easy to turn. The good part of the case is that it's pretty hard to turn the food aid part of the case. Most international relief efforts are currently working. They just don't have enough food to give out to all the people that are in line, so there aren't any good, like the army co-ops the food, the elites co-ops the food, doesn't get to the people who need it. There are good cards to say that it gets to whoever it needs to get to. There just isn't enough. So, nobody will ever counterplan not to lift the sanctions on you. They may counterplan to just do the food aid and not lift the sanctions. It could be a debate. The second wave I worked on, the Iran affirmative, which is great. Let's see, what do I want to say about Iran? Iran is an interesting affirmative because the plan is written like, well, the plan is written kind of funky, but it's not written like any other plan, and that is the plan is a quid pro quo. We give in initially, but anything else that gets given to Iran is conditioned upon their response to the immediate removal of sanctions and diplomatic overtures that we make. The quid pro quo that we specifically asked for in the plan is a embassy in Tehran. There's a specific solvency card for that that exists in the U.S.-Iranian relations advantage. There are four total advantages to the case, I think. There is the pro-lift. Well, let me do it this way. The first one is just relations with Iran. We claim that, that's the Tehran part. The second is the moderates and the conservatives debate inside Iran right now. The conservatives are cracking down on a lot of student protests that have been going on for like 10 or 11 days in a row now, which has just happened to randomly coincide with our research. But the moderates are still kind of in control over what's going on. In other words, the population is moderating and becoming more moderate. They've elected more and more moderates. In the 2000 elections, all the evidence says that they'll make huge gains and potentially even have the ability to control the government. But right now, the control of the government is in the hands of the conservatives. Our argument is that by opening constructive engagement and decreasing sanctions, we bolster the moderates' arguments that they can eliminate the evil sanctions that take their toll on the population, and that allows them to make more significant gains in the next election and prevents the radicals from taking control. And right now, it's a good time to do that, because right now is the last chance that the conservatives are going to have to leverage their control. The next advantage is pro-lift. I like the Provis advantage because I found out that it skirts that non-proliferation critique that got written by the Provis lab. Our argument is that Prolif in Iran is inevitable, but it'll be slow, it'll status quo, it'll take them between 3 and 10 years to actually acquire a bomb. Engagement now prevents crises from occurring between those 3 and 10 years that will give them motivation to quickly acquire nuclear weapons. So smoothing out those crises prevents crisis escalation from occurring, and by the time they get the bomb, we'll have strong enough ties with them to draw them into regional security arrangements that prevent Israel from freaking out once Iran proliferates. It's a pretty good little story. It doesn't emphasize non-proliferation, it emphasizes the management of existing proliferation, which doesn't work for that competing thing.
And it's got a pretty good impact, which is Israeli speak out.
People will also try to claim that they get Islam links off of that advantage because we said those crazy Iranians are going to prolif. That's not true. Our argument is that the crazy Israelis are going to bomb the Arabs who are, you know, just prolifing because you prolif too if the Israelis were right next door to you. Okay? We're not saying the crazy Arabs are going to prolif and cause all kinds of things. All right. The last advantage is your Iranian economy. It stinks now. There's massive unemployment. Our argument is that lots of foreign investment would happen if you release sanctions. The best negative cards against this advantage are the ones that claim that nobody would go there once we lift the sanctions. But our argument against that is that 11 people applied for contracts in Iran, and zero of them were allowed to do them in the last year, which has deterred anybody else from even applying for them. You may notice that the index says Iran asked, but like there's negative stuff that's in each of the places where it goes. So like there's negative stuff to answer each of the affirmative arguments in the index with those affirmative arguments. That's where it all lies. If you wanted to run this as affirmative, you should research terrorism, and you should research oil a little bit more. We have some internal links that say that the sanctions will prevent Iran from taking place and from participating in the oil pipeline, and that Turkey will lead it. But we don't have any of the cards that say Turkey-led oil pipeline back, which is what you would need to complete the turn for that Caspian oil position, which you will inevitably need to turn. And there's good U.S. economy disad turns that are carefully and auspiciously labeled links. Pages 75, 76, and 77 should all be grouped together as sanctions on Iran for the U.S. economy so we can turn everybody's spending critiques into fiscal policy. Right on.
And the first wave, I did Cuba. I encourage everyone to read the summary on the front that we put out because it has two different options for plans in it, and it also explains why the case is put together the way it is and how you should perhaps be running it. It doesn't say much about negative strategies. But first, the case is very long. If you cannot read ridiculously fast like Jenko, as it says here, then you need to only read the starred part. We cut it down for you so there's a short version as well. The case as it's written is in three contentions, and if you only read those three contentions, what you have is what we conceptualize as a Cuba-only case. The first contention talks about, we call it Cuban crisis, the suffering going on in Cuba right now due to lack of appropriate medical care and lack of food. And that contention just goes through, we talk about what the situation is, and then we talk about the morality of that. This contention one is sort of self-contained, it can be its own advantage, and what it maintains is that we are waging war on an individual and his government at the expense of starving children and poor people, and that is an immoral policy regardless of what other implications there are to the policy. You can't sacrifice these people to achieve this political end. Now, contention two talks about the actual, I guess, sort of non-ethical impacts of the policy, and it talks about that we wrote this contention because we wanted to avoid the debate about who would be in power and what was the best way for our policy to bolster who would be in power, because that's a very contentious debate. It's very deep, it's hard to take a position on, and we wanted to write a particular solvency story to screen out a certain counterplan, and I'll tell you about that. What Contention 2 says is that a transition is inevitable. Some sort of a huge political transition is going to occur. The only question is what the outcome of that is and whether it will be peaceful or violent. And what we say is that a policy of engagement could help us ensure that the transition that's going to occur will be peaceful. And we say the way to do that is by a phased-in policy, a constructive engagement policy that is slow and sort of gives the opposition and the current government time to adjust, and you know, that way we'll come smooth into a very peaceful transition and all will be well and good. Why we want to say that slow transition, a lifting of some sanctions with a conditioned approach, would be better, constructive engagement, as opposed to what the counterplan is, which is immediate lifting of all sanctions. A lot of people were running out at camp, immediate and unconditional lifting. And we say that would be too jarring, it would cause a violent transition, which would result in a massive, bloody civil war. And that the way to avoid that is slow, phased-in transition, not the counterplan alternative. I see there's a question. And then we have solvency for that, and I talked about that. Is that they're shifting now, we can help that by engagement, we'll lay some groundwork for a more stable transition, it won't be violent, and that it could be flooding. That's where the impacts for that are. Remember that in Advantage 1, you also get straight up impacts besides ethical implications, which are people are starving to death and they're dying because of lack of adequate medical care. There is a debate on this whole medical care thing, what's going on. They're supposedly have this great medical system. There's good evidence that says they can't get medicine from us. There's a system that it only protects the elite. All of the aid and money that we funnel in will go into that system. That's very debatable. But I think the ethical portions of the case are just pretty much right on. You know, we are just fixated on Castro, and we don't care who we have to harm to achieve our political ends of getting him out of power. Two other advantages. Caribbean security advantage is the first one, and it just says we isolate Cuba. They're not part of the Cuban security and economic framework. They're not involved in those discussions. If we didn't isolate them, they would be reintegrated, and we could make progress on issues where we need to make progress, such as terrorism, drug trafficking, and then it talks about a variety. There's sort of a laundry list of other security and economic issues that we could encourage dialogue on, and thus have impact from that. It's kind of a nebulous impact. If someone wanted to do the research, they could, you know, probably get something much better. We don't read a huge blinking impact in terms of terrorism. That's a good idea. Free trade advantage. This is, you know, very similar to the story on the DISADs and other things that are going on. Other of the international law discussions that are occurring in other groups who have done research. The story is, because of Holmes Burton, the United States finds the domestic subsidiaries of foreign corporations doing business in Cuba. For example, if there's a company based in Great Britain who does business with Cuba and they also happen to have branches of their company in the United States, we'll slap a huge old fine on it. And they don't like this. It is a violation of, arguably, of several of our international trade agreements and just of international law in general. The argument is that this will cause a breakdown in our trade agreements and it hurts U.S. credibility in free trade issues, which hurts U.S. leadership generally, and that U.S. leadership is good. That's the implication of that advantage. I think this advantage has some weaknesses. The first being that there's really a compromise brewing over all of these issues about violating international law and whether it violates our free trade agreement, and the best evidence we found says they've reached a compromise and it's going to pass through Congress and stuff. Quite well, except it, everything's going to be hunky-dory. So I don't know. I've been talking to other group leaders who did work on the topic, and they think the debate may be just as strong the other way. So, you know, use your judgment, but you need to figure out and get confident on that state before you try. to do it, because I think it's pretty complicated today. And then there are answers for all of the advantages and the negatives, and they're separated out into a separate group of negative stuff. There are counter plans. There's something called the grand bargain counter plan. It's kind of interesting. Read the cards. You can figure out what it is. It basically says we bribe Castro to step down, you know, we let him kind of go out in glory, and he does. That's one counter plan. And then the other counter plan is the immediate non-conditional lifting of all sanctions. And that's the main negative, but the answer's all these things. If you have questions, you can talk to me after, I guess.
For the first wave, Pat and I put together an affirmative case and a critique on feminist international relations. The basic position, the main case authors are like Ann Tickner and B. Spike Peterson and Christine Sylvester. Those are the main advocates for this position. They contend that the status quo foreign policy, the realist model of foreign policy, that indicates that power projection and hegemony and United States sort of intervention into other countries' affairs, that this type of foreign policy is only one model of foreign policy among many other options. But we've sort of come to accept it as the only model of foreign policy, as the natural or right way. These authors contend that this type of foreign policy exhibits masculinist tendencies or masculinist traits. Now what this means is it doesn't mean that because men are in there, these are traits of men. These authors claim that foreign policy exhibits what is conceptually known as masculine traits. So it's not attached to male or female. It's more of a gender sort of construction argument. So foreign policy is in a masculinist framework, and the way that we talk about our foreign policy has profound implications on how it gets enacted. So when we talk about foreign policy or when we construct scenarios, that this actually reifies this perception of foreign policy in this way. These authors contend that we must reframe foreign policy to include more of what are standardly known as feminine perspectives. Once again, not just the inclusion of women in foreign policy, since these authors contend that just putting women into a masculine framework is not going to solve. We need to actually rethink the framework and the way the foreign policy is framed. And the inevitable goal is to ungender international relations. So it's not just to have all women in power. That's sort of a liberalist feminist perspective that these authors do not accept. The affirmative, so that's just a general position, the affirmative claims that sanctions specifically are a tool of this leverage of this hegemonic masculinist mindset. Sanctions sort of epitomize that. You know, we penalize other countries and say bad. So Cuba is, the case is particular to Cuba. Cuba, the evidence from Weber states that the United States has a castration complex, that our foreign policy towards Cuba, the way that we have treated Cuba, has defined how we treat all other countries in foreign policy. And so the story goes that if we look at sanctions and change foreign policy towards Cuba, that then our framing of foreign policy will be turned into a stimulus, will be in crisis, and we will change our perspective on foreign policy. There's evidence in there that says other countries model our foreign policy, so if we change foreign policy, you might get, you'll argue some sort of transition story to a feminist IR perspective. The impacts on the case are that the current masculinist framework ensures wars, annihilation, destruction of the environment, death of the planet, and that reframing our foreign policy will avoid this in from this perspective. The critique pretty much goes along the same way, except obviously the way the links are that the type of foreign policy used by the affirmative reinforces this. There's two implications to the critique. The first is a solvency term. When you use a framework, the feminist IR authors say that this type of masculinist framework is inappropriate for dealing with crises. So the first implication of the critique is that you will not be able to adequately address crises, that you will just perpetuate war and violence, et cetera, and not solve anything. So it acts as a solvency turn, and second of all, at discourse level, the way that we talk about foreign policy, if you keep mentioning or if you keep constructing foreign policy in a way that reifies this masculinist framework, that you actually perpetuate that type of foreign policy. So those are the two sort of implications to the critique. Just a note, since the critique and the affirmative are pretty much the same argument in different positions, don't just look at the, you know, if you're interested in running the critique or the affirmative or both, don't just look at the critique extensions. The affirmative case extensions also will provide you a lot of arguments as well. Additionally, the critique solvency evidence might also, you know, work for your affirmative solvency evidence. So it's all intermixed. And finally, something that is important to note is that the critique links, the links that say X is masculinist foreign policy, if you are an affirmative and you're arguing the FMIR position and you hear some dissads, you can use the critique links as answers to the dissads. Like, for instance, there's a nuclear rhetoric or nuclear discourse, you know, claims that everything will end in nuclear war. It's just a reification of masculinist foreign policy. Well, if you're affirmative and the negative runs, you know, big dissad with a big nuclear war scenario or five different scenarios or something, you can read the nuclear discourse link as a turn to their position, linking their scenario construction to your critique. So it's a way of link turning in a position and saying you solve for that. So that's just a note. Always look at the link because there'll be answers to this as well.
In the second wave, Gina and I worked on postmodern international relations theory. How many of y'all are familiar with a political philosopher named Hobbes? Okay, so quite a few. So you know what the state of nature means when you talk about Hobbes? It's a place where life is nasty, brutish, and short. The theory, according to Hobbes, is that absent some sort of a governing structure, the natural state of relations between individuals is an anarchic, violent state. This is what he calls the state of nature, where people just sort of kill each other for whatever they can get their hands on. This theory largely undergirds the entire Western history of politics, including international relations theory. And so the theory in international relations theory largely goes that absent some sort of a guiding force, international relations naturally devolve to a state of nature, in which countries have a constant cycle of war. In response to this, there are two dominant themes, I think, in Western international relations theory that have tried to deal with what they perceive as the natural state that we devolve to. The first and most dominant is the realist school of international relations, which not only dominates international relations theory, but largely dominates academic debate. And that is that what you need is the capacity to exert force in order to maintain control. And that force can be military or economic, but absent a hegemon, or a pair or trio of hegemons that balance each other, what you get is a cycle of war. And so according to the realists, what you have is basically power politics. If you want to have global security, you have to have big militaries and very strong economies that can force quote-unquote rogue nations to comply with the imposed global order, the new world order. And so that's sort of the dominant school. The other school that I think is pretty prevalent and not nearly as dominant, though, is more like a liberalist school, which says that we could all get along if we just sign contracts and treaties and agreements and yield some individual sovereignty to multinational organizations and treaty organizations and such, and that we could come to some sort of contractual mutual government. Postmodern international relations criticizes both the realist and the liberalist schools, first because if they make an unwarranted assumption that the state of nature is chaos and war. And what it seems is that what the postmodernists point out is that if such is true, it is largely true because we have made it that way. That is to say that the capacity to theorize about what a state of nature is not an objective description, but it's a prescription of what we will call the state of nature and how we will interact. So if I say the state of nature is chaos, war, and violence, absent government, that's what we get, then what we do is we create a world in which that is true. It's not objectively or necessarily true, it's contingently true, created by the discourses and theorizing that we do. So postmodern international relations first takes that into question. The second is that the model of state-to-state or nation-state relations is largely a model that is somewhat, you know, an invention of a particular strand of history.
And so the idea that nation-state to nation-state or state-to-state relations are what international relations are about, in the very idea of the term international relations, already presupposes a concept of what it means to relate to each other cross-culturally, cross-boundaries, cross-geography, that imposes upon us a particular identity formation, an identity formation that we as individuals consider ourselves instantiations or examples of our nation state. So nationalism, which is the flip side of patriotism, becomes the model by which international relations operate. So modernity is sort of, the undergirding philosophy that holds all of this together. So what is modernism or modernity? Modernism or modernity might be described as a faith in meta-narratives. What's a meta-narrative? It's a big story that can hold all your little stories together. So we tell each other a story that says that scientific method provides truth about the objective universe so that we can control it in a way that it is productive and helpful towards humans. Now this story we've been telling ourselves at least since Francis Bacon, regardless of the fact that we do things like bomb the hell out of each other and use technology to make death camps. So, in no small part, the invention of the nuclear weapon and the occurrence of the Holocaust are what caused, are the major sort of impediments to the continuation of modernist faith. These are the culmination. They are the writ large of modernism, of technology, faith in technology, faith in science. You still have technology and science in postmodernism, you just don't have any faith in them anymore. Similarly, faith in God, that God will come down and save us. Faith in human nature, that, oh, if we could all just strip everything away, we're all the same underneath it all. Which usually means I'll make everyone else the same as I think we are. It's a form of colonization. And so postmodernism involves itself in dispersed narratives. It involves itself in questioning all of the faith that we have placed. Yeah, sure, we might still have a state, but we don't have faith in the state. We still have science technology, we don't have faith in science technology. We still are humans, it's not against people. It's just questions any idea of essential or natural. All right, so the case story. Case has no plan. Case has no plan. There's no need for a plan. The story on Case is we are the movement. Individual action and endorsement is key. You can change global international relations through individual action. I think parts that say that are pretty decent. And so we advocate out of Case that modernist international relations and foreign policy are bad. In particular, four of the topic nations are named in the cards in Observation 1. It says that we treat them badly, and that as a result, we are undergirded by an entire philosophy that basically replicates war, ecological destruction. So modernism and the philosophy of modernist international relations reproduces anthropocentrism, patriarchy, nationalism, militarism, ecological destruction, nuclearism, a whole bunch of other things too. Postmodernism solves all that. So the impacts are pretty phenomenal. The cards say like it's the only option for continued life on the planet. I think that's pretty good. So one thing you should know is there's at least two types of postmodernism, affirmative or constructive postmodernism and skeptical or nihilistic postmodernism. You'll find the cards that make the distinction. Nihilists just say, we're hurtling towards catastrophe, pop open the champagne. The affirmative or constructive postmodernists say we are hurtling towards catastrophe, we can probably do something about it, but we have to be very careful about it. They're always very skeptical about their political action, but they at least take political action. So we are affirmative or constructive postmodernists, to find the parts that say postmodern international relations theory is affirmative or constructive in the packet. The critique. The link is that the affirmative engages nation-state to nation-state, which is a modernist way of thinking about how we should relate to each other across geography and culture. Straight up. Topic says nation state and engage in it. Any affirmative that has bothered to think that they'll be in the topic will probably win. Nation state to nation state engagement. And so that's the link. But it says, I think, economic engagement. It doesn't say constructive engagement, but it says nation state to nation state economic engagement link. So it's okay. The other position we put out was post-colonialism. There's no impact to it. That's not true. That's not true at all. Let me take that back. There aren't traditional debate-style impacts to post-colonialism. We didn't cut any of the cards that say, like, huge genocide or nuclear war or anything for post-colonialism. But it just talks about how post-colonial thought, which is thought that continues Western domination, is natural even after we've removed the technical colonization of these countries. That is, we've taken the French government out of this area, but the entire Western model of government still dominates a region to which it is largely a foreign existence. And we naturally read them as extensions of Western political theory. So the post-colonial critique, the idea that we do that, it also links off the conflation of nation and state into one term. The link part says that nation and state are radically different concepts. To merge them together into an idea of nation state is a distinctly Western phenomenon that has corrupted our international relations thinking. That's the link part. So since the topic says nation state, I've got a figurable link. Then it says that that reproduces imperialism colonization. This packet also has some critique theory cards in it. It's about 6 pages or 7 pages of really, really good cost-benefit analysis. It's flawed cards from major policy analyst thinkers who make excellent arguments as to how any meaningful form of policy analysis has to reject cost-benefit modes and risk analysis modes. It's always astonishing to me that we think of ourselves as policy analysts in this activity and we pay no attention to policy analysis literature. So those cards will help you with critique stories. Then there's just some general critique theory cards and there's a couple pages of answers. The Polo case specifically, there are a bunch of cards that say postmodernism opposes feminism, and there are answers to that. That's a really great debate. Whether postmodernism helps or hurts feminism is a great debate. Oh, and yeah, and then that gives you links to the semi-archive, so you can debate it out that way. The postcolonialists kick the heck out of postmodernists. And so the postcolonialism packet has some really great comparative cards that says postcolonialism is better than postmodernism. We have to reject postmodernism because it's Eurocentric and Western and go with postcolonialism instead. There's a good chunk. It can't solve. It doesn't have political action. There's the standard kind of weak answers that say things like, you know, postmodernism is nihilistic, you can't act, you wouldn't even know, you know, how to open a door if you bought it, or whatever. And, you know, then there's, I think, some pretty meaty, solid sort of just straight-up answers. You know, there's some case turns. The card says something like nihilistic postmodernism, or it's also known as like pure deconstructive postmodernism or skeptical postmodernism, it'll go by a different name. It says that basically they say, the card's really funny, it says, they see the impending apocalypse, nuclear catastrophe, ecological devastation, asteroids colliding with the Earth, the sun exploding, and heat death of the universe, and they just think there's nothing you can do about it. So why try? The affirmatives don't say, you know, we might be able to solve at least some of those things. Maybe not heat death of the universe, you know, but you know, we might be able to forestall a nuclear catastrophe. So the affirmatives engage in political action.
You said there wasn't a lot of research in the post-colonialism, but could you give us some examples if we want to go with
I think the post-colonialism literature overlaps really strongly with the Islam literature that came out of the first wave. Edward Said, who's one of the major Orientalism Islam people, is also probably one of the most commonly cited people in the post-colonialism literature. We also want to look at, I can't spell her last name, her first name, but the last name is Spivak, S-P-I-V-A-K. It's like watery or guitar-y. Can you spell it?
Yeah. G-A-Y-A-T-R-I. Spivak, S-P-I-V-A-K.
They're all a collection of readers. The post-colonial readers that are out there, which are a collection of edited articles.
And Genevieve, is that a good one too? Yeah. Oh, Homi Baba, that's the other one. I can't spell that. Is it D-A? B-H-A-B-A? Where the H and B go? Sorry. If you pull the stuff that we cut and go through their bibliographies, you'll be fooled though.
Look at the Journal Millennium. Like, when I go home, they don't have Journal Millennium here. When I go home, I'll pull the last 6, 8, maybe 10 years in the Journal Millennium off the shelf and go through every issue of it. Because all it does is, like, feminist international relations, post-colonial international relations, postmodern international relations, all that kind of stuff.
On the Korea case, or not Korea, Cuba, the plan states is the plan advocates, or the plan wants to lift sanctions immediately, right? Like, what's the
first immediately?
Right. Okay. So, but don't the authors assume a graduate change? So, how do you avoid the topicality argument? Like, we've been running Cuba, and we keep getting slapped with topicality because we say immediate, and our authors assume gradual. And, like, obviously gradual is better according to the evidence.
Are you running the plan that we suggest running and that we designed the Cuba case to be run with is not a plan that says immediately and unconditionally lift all sanctions. That's a counterplan.
Mm-hmm.
And we designed the transition scenario to be a dissad to that counterplan. And I guess there are arguments about whether the immediate unconditional lifting of all sanctions is topical because it doesn't seem to be constructive engagement.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the plan we suggest you run.
Okay.
I mean, is that the plan you've been running and the one you're concerned about?
Well,
or just the one, like lifting Helms-Burton does not lift all the sanctions against Cuba.
Right. We ran just the original, like, we only ran it a couple of times now in North Korea, but like we ran the original Cuba case, the old one, and what it said was it advocated lifting all or nearly all sanctions
right.
immediately.
You're talking about
and
the original Cuba
too.
Packet. There's
yeah.
like there's a solvency card
one
that says the gradual. Okay.
Yeah. That's not what this does.
Okay.
This plan, we repealed Helms-Burton,
right.
which Helms-Burton. Took the power, one of the main things it did was took power away from the executive, the president, to conduct foreign policy, economic policy towards Cuba as he saw fit. And that's somewhat unprecedented for Congress sort of to take this foreign policy power, I think you could say. And so it has to be lifted in order really for us to have any flexibility in our policy. But merely lifting it does not mean that all sanctions are lifted. It just means now we have some flexibility in our foreign policy. And the other thing that the plan says to do, specifically that Helms-Burton does do, is it says we will no longer find domestic subsidiaries of foreign corporations doing business in the United States, which is how you get the free trade advantage. And then we also give some humanitarian and food aid and
get rid
of all licensing.
That second action that you just talked about, the no longer buying domestic subsidiaries of foreign countries, that's an immediate removal of all the sanctions that exist on all the countries around the world that have peace.
Okay.
But it's not, we don't list all sanctions against Cuba by any means, and we, you know, we're engaged with them. It's slow. Yeah. It's not everything.
What would not be the what are you thinking would be included in the first round?
We don't take a position. But we just don't say, you know, we're very specific about what will be lifted and that's sort of how we leave it and you know, there's a variety of reasons for that, avoidance of the exclusion counterplans. But you know, there are some political restrictions. We'd still be pushing for political liberalization using our sanctions as tools to do that. But all the humanitarian, anything that could be defined as humanitarian is listed. Helms-Burton is listed so that there's foreign policy flexibility now towards Cuba. And then we list the specific sanction we need to lift to get the free trade advantage. And the rest of it, you can argue with us about, or you can argue with the affirmative about whether it's lifted or not. We'll purposely make about it. And that's the best answer.
Is there any list or any idea of what would be considered humanitarian? Or is that up for debate? Is there any other case or any description? Can I interpret agriculture as humanitarian?
Yes.
you could, we don't define it, but our cards specifically talk about humanitarian aid and how it cannot ever, should never be humanitarian. Well, sanctions on food and medicine is what it said, should never be part of policies to change political or economic behavior because it's too inhumane. And if you want to define sanctions on food as agriculture, I think that's probably certainly arguable. Our cards don't say that. They just say food and medicine. You can't sanction those
things. Hey, have you not read any of the Solvency articles for the camp affirmative? The card that everybody points to in the practice debates that I've watched that proves that the authors assume a gradual shift and not an immediate, it doesn't talk about a gradual lifting of sanctions. It talks about a gradual encouragement of democracy, which is entirely different. You could immediately lift all sanctions and so gradually encourage democracy.
There's a ton of links provided for the position, and you can actually argue that the semi-R takes links in another way to the to its critique. The critique links are like free trade, economics, democratization, these sorts of things. Realist foreign policy, engagement.
I think Gina's right, the engagement is key. Like whatever their constructive engagement policy is probably going to fit the definition of masculine international relations. I think that'd be right. And you know, I think the free trade issue, I'd go through the WTO packet, because the stuff that says lifting sanctions causes globalization of the economy will loop you back into the FEMIR packet that talks about globalization of the economy crushes feminism.
That's
on
WTO,
is that MAI?
Yeah, WTO.
Okay, well, wherever it is, wherever those cards are.
In the
MAS.
Right. So there can actually be a debate as to whether or not the case links. But yeah, the main link is off of the foreign policy mindset of engagement and intervening in the affairs. So just lifting the sanctions alone, I don't think would link to the critique, but you can consider whether or not the implications, letting the markets in, letting, you know, a country that has been cut off for a while, you can also argue that. But yeah, the links are mainly off of globalization, economy, constructive engagement as not really just cooperation, but coercion. That's a good question. What I would suggest in the packet for that, obviously there are many ways to go about it, but the evidence that indicates that the way that we talk about our foreign policy is incredibly important, like how we talk about relations between countries. So you can argue that, you know, look, the affirmative doesn't pass anything. They don't solve for hundreds of thousands of deaths of, you know, or whatever. But what actually happens, you know, real implication, is the way that we talk about foreign policy in the round actually has changed, actually has effects on people. And that's all the evidence that indicates that discourse is key and that the critique solves. So if you just look at it in a way of what are the implications of what we are saying in the debate, instead of how many, you know, how many deaths you have, which no one ever really solves for. I mean, it's just a discussion of these things. And so the critique, one of the implications of the critique could be that, along with the solvency argument, which does sort of engage in that, you know, do you solve not. So the critique could be sort of like in both ways, in both sort of camps at once. But just the way that we talk about these things has more of an effect than what the 2AR claims that they solve for.
The other thing I'll say is that they don't have any impacts. The affirmative doesn't explain the impacts. Even in like a post-fiat policy world, the affirmative has zero impacts because their entire model for thinking about international relations has been fundamentally indicted as an inaccurate, flawed model that reproduces conflict. So all of the scenarios that the affirmative constructs and all of their solvency cards fundamentally operate from a method of analysis that doesn't work. Doesn't work. They're wrong. And so it's sort of like if all of the affirmative cards utilized a method of geometry that I could prove didn't work, you wouldn't care how many cards from that method of geometry got read, there's still no impact to them. So until such time as the affirmative can reassert their framework and prove that masculinist IR, realism, liberalism, modernist IR, whatever, is accurate, works, solves problems, they have no impact. There's nothing for them to weigh. So it's a straight case term.
We're just saying someone's desk is like, but that is the correct way now, right? Like, I mean, that card is just, it's correct now, but
yeah,
it's different later. And
yeah,
that's the,
yeah,
like, time frame on the, like, on the, this has happened before we change our...
All the cards in the critique say that's wrong. It's not correct. That's the way we think, but that's exactly why we have recurring wars.
So it's the other way right, and we just don't know it yet.
It works
in
better.
Way wrong, like it's really wrong.
The way we have now reproduces war, conflict, ecological destruction, devastation. It doesn't solve the problems. It makes them worse and continues them and repeats them, right? Which means that all of the affirmative cards are indicted at the methodological level.
Right.
Methodologically, the way they make is already toast. So you can't just read more cards from that paradigm. You have to justify the paradigm.
Last question.
Yeah, there is. I don't know if we didn't, you know, we weren't looking at, our cards may say MAI internally, but we did not tag them that lifting of Helms Burton does not cause MAI. They would more say things like it doesn't violate international law, it's not going to hurt our international trade agreements, because we didn't know that the scenario coming out of the other group was going to be an MAI specifically scenario. So we just talked about the implications for free trade agreements and international law agreements generally. So you actually need to read the cards, and they probably talk about MAI, and they definitely talk about the sort of issues and that the EU and other nations are having with us and how it's hurting our ability to negotiate other agreements, such as the MAI. And even though they're not, some of them may not be super specific, they certainly apply to that debate. So they're just under a different tagline than you might expect them to be.
You should definitely read them. Even it's better to read the cards for the last week of the MAI than just talk about trade in general than to read nothing.
And there are in corporate rule, maybe you disagree if you looked at it, but there are some parts like Chris was alluding to earlier that undercut both the link and the uniqueness claim in saying that they are close to reaching an agreement on outstanding friction over sanctions on Cuba. Your story that holds back MAI isn't true, but if it is true, it's going to happen because they're not in friction, it's very friction now, or won't be soon. I think they have cards that say that, sounds like we have two cards that said that, I think that's where you go.
Ours are under the title of compromise. They're reaching compromise, that's what all the tags say on those particular cards. And unless you understand the nuances of the story, you may not know why the compromise is relevant, but that's where they are.
Okay, they just loaded Pummel into the copier, so
Clubhouse is coming out soon. If anything comes up, it's Popier.
Okay, so Popier, Popier.
And right after Cuomo, Rush is being run and Post will be next, so check regularly.